This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, key GOP leaders want a change in Iraq strategy, and an attorney for a terrorist gets 2 years in jail. Joining us today from our New York bureau is Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, is in our Chicago bureau. And from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. Thank you all for joining us. And I just wonder if anyone has any reaction to the Gullah Geechee Preservation Bill, because it seems to me that there are so many different ethnic cultures in America. And at certain points, like the post-Depression period, we have gone out and tried to preserve American cultures, you know, actually spent federal money on it. And at other points, we haven't. How important is this, Glenn?
Well, I would distinguish between preserving for future generations the art, literature, language, style of life, and such that can be available for people to look back upon and to know how a group of people were living. I distinguish between that on the one hand and freezing in place a way of life, protecting it and propping it up against all the economic pressures of change going around on the other. The latter, I don't think, is necessarily a viable project. I mean, I understand the emotions and the feelings of people, but the pressures of economic change, you know, are the children going to stay or are they going to move to the city? What do you do about tremendously valuable land that people are willing to pay for that creates incentives for individuals to sell? You, in some sense, can't stop the hand of time. So, you know, I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, but I just want to say this is an issue all over the world of indigenous peoples being impacted by modernity, wanting to hold on to their language and hold on to their way of life, but finding it very difficult to do.
Laura, what about, excuse me, Laura, what about that?
Well, I think Mr. Campbell put his finger on it, the activist who said, you know, he talked about living assets. And I think those are two very important words. These are living, ongoing assets, human resources, artifacts that are, the basket was a great example of that. These are not things that are necessarily frozen in time, and these are things that, in fact, have evolved over time and are contributing to a culture, to a community, and maybe not necessarily economically the way land is when it gets transferred to big developers, but that still make a difference. And I think we spend so much time and so much money on preserving history, in fact, freezing it in time, as Glenn talks about. We spend far more money, hundreds of millions of dollars on slavery museums, on African American history museums, and those are important, but we don't pay enough attention to preserving and promoting and supporting the ongoing human resources, living resources in these communities, people who are doing work, who are contributing to society.
Michael, it strikes me that this is not just a black and white issue. You know, I grew up in Maryland, and there's a lot of Appalachian culture there, but I would suspect that a lot of the places where, you know, you find the real roots, bluegrass musicians and things like that are disappearing as well. I mean, you know, as Glenn was saying, do we kind of have to just accept the passing of time and know that certain traditions may not exist?
Yeah, that's right. Cultures change, and they're not like oil and water. They mix. So I just, you know, if I say, hi, y'all, is that the Geechee in me or in my family background? And if it is, what in the world does the government have to do with, quote unquote, cultural preservation? I'm always wary when government gets involved in cultural preservation movements. It's always paternalistic ring to it. Can you spell casinos, reservations, Bureau of Indian Affairs?
I don't know that we can put those in the same category.
Well, I do. And if the issue is, because it's outrageous pork barrel. I heard pork barrel too. You know, some congressman wanted some funding for his quote unquote community, and he got it because of personal favor. This is not a compelling state interest.
Michael, I'm shocked that you're surprised that a congressman is interested in pork barrel.
No, I'm not shocked by it. I'm outraged and annoyed by it.
But you know what? I think you do make a good point, and you know, I don't have any problem with federal assets going to this kind of thing. But I think that I didn't hear anything about, really specifically, about how this money was going to be spent, and I didn't hear anything in that conversation about where other, I mean, $1 million or so is not going to do, it's not going to touch the surface. What about the foundations? What about individuals who, wealthy individuals or other folks who have connections in this community? I'd like to see some support coming from those areas.
But if the issue is land ownership, what about the land? How are you going to preserve people on their land in terms of ownership? That hasn't been touched. And I guess what? My prediction is it won't be touched. It will have gentrification and private development, and that culture will again change, this time with the impetus of government funding.
You know, I have to make an economist point here. This is Glenn Lowry, which is simply that even if you didn't change the use of the land, if there were developers out there who were willing to pay, I don't know, $10 million or $100 million for a strip of land and you kept them out, in effect, you'd be spending $100 million in order to keep the land the way it is. And then the question I would ask is, okay, you want to preserve culture? How much are you willing to pay to do it? Because if you forego a business opportunity that could generate jobs and could generate a lot of money, in effect, that's how much you will be paying in order to stay just the way you are. If you ask the typical person walking around on the street in such a community, how much are they willing to pay? I think that number is going to be finite. It's not going to be $1 million. It's not going to be $100 million.
Amen, brother. But,
can take some of that $100 million, and if the developer wants that land badly enough, and believe me, he will, you put a $10 or $15 million aside for some cultural preservation.
Yeah, you can do that.
All right, let me move on to Iraq, which has been a consistent theme over the past few weeks. Two leading Republican senators are now pushing for a new strategy, Chuck Hagel of Nebraska and John Warner of Virginia. And Warner, of course, was one of the lead opponents to the president on the issue of how the detainees in Guantanamo were being categorized and treated. Now, this isn't necessarily a full-on revolt, but they're just saying what is happening now is not working, which is something that, of course, Democrats have been saying, but neither side necessarily has left, has put new options on the table.
Some Democrats have been saying, and some Republicans have been saying, that they want a new strategy. Look, these politicians, they know how to talk the talk. They don't know how to walk the walk. They're like tea leaf readers. They try to read the public. They say certain things, particularly prior to the election, and they do the exact opposite after the election. We are not fooled. Don't watch what they do. I mean, they don't want us to watch what they do. They want us to listen to how they talk. I want to see how they vote. I want to see what they do. I want to see the new strategy. Where is the votes? Where's the proposal, the motion to get out of Iraq? Where's the defunding of our military presence in Iraq? And all this is just rhetoric. I mean, and it includes the smearing of some Democrats who want to get out of Iraq, including the most militaristic and the people who have served in the military, calling them cut-and-run defeaters. These are some Republicans saying this to these Democrats. And there are some Democrats saying to Democrats, you're defeatists as well. So I'm tired of the double talk. And double talk means exactly that, talking out of both sides of your mouth.
Laura, should people like Chuck Hagel and John Warner be putting proposals on the table, or is that not their place?
That would be nice. It'd be nice to see some kind of a concrete proposal. I think that Michael's right. There's been a lot of rhetoric. I was shocked. You know, fine. You know, I think that they have a case to make that we do need to look at some hard choices here. But I was shocked by what Carl Levin of Michigan said. You know, he basically, I thought it was very flip. He said, if they're going to have a civil war, they're going to have to do it without us. If only it were that simple. We have to come up with a way to get out of there so that we don't leave a catastrophe behind us, because it won't just be a civil war in Iraq. It will be a civil war throughout the entire region. And I have not seen anybody yet. And maybe the plan is impossible to come up with until after the elections. But I'd like to see some kind of a concrete plan that both sides of Congress and the Iraqis can agree on. And I haven't seen it yet.
Glenn, roughly 100 people have been killed in the past few days, Iraqis, in sectarian violence, again leading people to really talk about, there's going to be a civil war if there isn't one already. What responsibility does the U.S. have to stay, even if the country becomes completely ungovernable and has essentially no government?
Well, you know, we broke it. We obviously have a responsibility not to withdraw precipitously and simply let things, run whatever course they're going to run. And the maintenance of security in the country, such as security is in the country, wouldn't be possible if our troops weren't there. I mean, you know, this is a horrible, horrible mess. Of course, saying that doesn't solve anybody's problem. We're going to have a change, of course. There's not any doubt about that after the election. This commission that's out there that Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton are heading is going to report after the election. There's going to be a change, of course. We need to communicate credibly to the political actors in Iraq that we are not going to be there forever. And if they can't get their acts together, learn how to accommodate Shia power, deal with the Sunnis' needs to have some share of oil revenues when there are no oil wells practically on their land, and deal with the Kurdish demand for autonomy. If the Iraqis can't solve that political problem, obviously we can't solve it for them. So, I mean, we have to use our presence there as a lever, the threat to withdraw and leave them with the mess in order to force them to come to grips with the political problems which only they can solve.
In a related topic, yesterday, civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart was sentenced to 28 months in prison. Now, she was convicted in 2005 of aiding terrorists. The court found that she'd helped her imprisoned client, the Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, send messages to the outside world against federal orders. The essence is that she passed along a press release that some said called for attacks on the government. Rahman is serving a life sentence for planning explosive attacks in New York City. She could have gotten 30 years. She got 28 months. She has cancer. She's 67 years old. Was the court too lenient, too harsh, just right? Michael?
You're asking the wrong person. I have absolutely no idea why she only got 28 months. I have a lot of speculation, however. But I think some of the factors that a judge considers is the health of the defendant and the age of the defendant, as well as the community public service of the defendant in this case. Not only Lynn Stewart doesn't just have breast cancer, she also has diabetes. And I think the judge, in his discretion, decided that maybe a long prison term, such as the government was asking for, would not only be a hardship, it would probably be a death sentence for Lynn Stewart. But, you know, you got to remember that Lynn Stewart is appealing her guilty verdict as well. So this is not a final chapter in any event. And the government may very well appeal the sentence if they can show that the judges abused his discretion or his authority within the sentencing guidelines of the federal law. And therefore, the appellate courts are going to have a say in this, not just the editorial boards of our newspapers.
Well, part of this is an argument that I believe Stewart would make, is it's I was just being a good lawyer to my client. Does that hold up, Laura?
Well, I think it was not quite that simple. As I understand it, she did acknowledge at some point after her conviction that there, maybe she had made some lapses in judgment, so to speak. Maybe she had made some mistakes and maybe had gone too far. So I think that the sentence was completely fair. You know, Michael talks about a death sentence. Even a couple years, like she's getting, given her condition, her age, her condition, given the kind of treatment you get in prisons, could easily be a death sentence. She's not going to ever be able to practice law again. She's not a threat to society, as the prosecution tried to allege, because she's not going to have access to the legal system, and she's not going to be able to do the kinds of things that she did before. I thought that it was kind of interesting that she was a little bit, I think, taken aback and pleasantly surprised at the sentence, but she also came ready to go to jail with her overnight bag. So I think that we'll have to wait and see what happens with the appeal, but I think that this was a sentence that was fair given the level of crime.
The U.S. district judge who sentenced her said that she performed a public service not only to her clients but to the nation. What about the whole perspective, Glenn, that nobody, I mean, to my knowledge, nobody in their right mind really wants to represent terrorists, but someone has to do it according to our court system?
No, this is a very good point, and I'm not making any brief for Lynn Stewart. Evidently, based on the findings of the court, she broke the law. She's acknowledged pretty much as much, and she's being punished. I think the punishment is appropriate. But I think this point that you're making, Farai, somebody has to defend people who are in the dock. That's the way our system works. It's an adversarial system. We want them to have the most competent defense within the law that they can possibly have is exactly right. And to the extent that there's a sentiment that says, let's go get, in the government's desire for a really punitive heavy hand here, let's go get the lawyers who defend these scumbags, that should be resisted. I see it happening here in Massachusetts in the gubernatorial race, where the candidate, a man named Deval Patrick, is being attacked by his Republican opponent for having worked as a public defender on behalf of a client who was a cop killer and gotten the sentence reduced from death to life in prison. The commercial says, it may be a lawyer's right to defend a cop killer, but do we really want one for our governor? And I think that's exactly the wrong sentiment. We want for our governor, and we want on the bar, people who are prepared to do the public service of defending persons who are presumed innocent until proven guilty. And so I would certainly emphasize that point.
But criminal defense is lawful. This is, she was not brought up because she was a lawyer.
Oh, no, I understand that. But the punitive spirit behind it has something to do, I think, with the idea that if you're going to go into court and defend those scumbags, you're a person for whom we can have no sympathy.
Well,
I'm not defending her breaking the law. I'm just saying that we need people going into court defending.
I don't want to say without evidence that the government went after her because she was a person who was, quote-unquote, defending the terrorists. The government claims they had evidence and apparently got the conviction that she broke the law. She aided and abetted a person.
Yeah, the issue is whether 2 years or 30 years is the appropriate sentence. That's what I'm talking about.
And well, I think Glenn's right. If there's a chilling effect, if the government is targeting and going after extremely punitive sentences as a way of chilling defense attorneys, I think that's something that we don't want to tolerate.
And Laura, I guess when we think about all of the things that have been going on, debating what should happen to the detainees at Guantanamo, I mean, where is it in America's kind of view right now to really champion the rights to trial? Because it seems to be very much in flux right now, briefly.
I think Americans don't understand the uneven playing field that attorneys that are representing folks at Guantanamo are operating under. They, you know, the sentiment is fine that these guys are terrorists and we have to protect society from them, but they don't understand that these folks have virtually no rights. Their lawyers often don't have access to them for months at a time, and that this kind of a system is being engineered by the government. I think they'd be a lot more outraged about it.
And let's not forget that the defense attorneys from Guantanamo and other quote-unquote terrorists have not been jailed, have not been accused of committing crimes. They are giving a vigorous defense, including some of the military lawyers who believe in the Constitution, who believe in the law, and saying the government itself is violating the law. So I don't want to mix those lawyers up with a lawyer who has apparently been adjudicated to be guilty of aiding a so-called and convicted terrorist.
All right.
There's a big difference.
We're going to have to leave it there. Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Glenn Lowry, Professor of the Social Sciences and Professor of Economics at Brown University. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.